Okay, thank you very much. And thank you, Michelle, for asking me along. I guess that I've made the assumption that the majority of people here won't really know what I do. So as a consequence, I sort of arranged the material that I'm going to show you and talk to you about, partly as a sort of explanatory introduction to what I do, as well as a sort of way of focusing it on its relationship to archival material. So I hope I've done the right thing there. And I know that there are certain people who are familiar with my work, like Jeff, for instance. So if you are, then I apologise, and you have to just sort of bear with me, basically. What I thought I'd do is give you a kind of snapshot of three projects that I've worked on over the last 6 years that all involve some element of recreation and all involve some element of research into an archive of the event that is being, or moment, or situation, or object that is being recreated. And in each one of these projects, the idea of recreation is played out in a very slightly different way. And what I want to do is kind of focus your attention mostly actually on that, and sort of try and explore a little bit what the relationship is between creating and recreating, and how we might think about that in relationship to archival material. So the first project that I'm going to show you, in some senses, is the most straightforward. These projects are also chronological, which is actually just a kind of coincidence. This project was made in 2002 and was a reconstruction, a live performance, and then a video of a very famous social psychology experiment conducted by a professor, Stanley Milgram, at Yale University in 1961. So Yale University has the archive of this material. They have, I haven't actually been there, but I've obviously spoken to many people who have. They have sort of 60 foot of, that's a good idea. Thank you. They have sort of 60 foot of walls, of shelf space dedicated to this, what is in the social sciences a very, very important social psychology experiment. The experiment is called Obedience to Authority, and it involved testing people's obedience to an authority figure, whether or not they would be willing to punish another person under a certain set of circumstances. I'm not really going to go into the kind of intricacies of the psychology experiment, nor actually of the reenactment that I conducted, because I don't really think there's time, and I think we'll end up getting kind of sidetracked in the sort of minutiae of what I actually did. But needless to say, the way that this played out was, first of all, a lot of research into that archive and liaising with Yale and gathering material from them. And that material included, crucially, transcripts of the original experiment. And the live reconstruction that I made was actually essentially a live articulation of those transcripts. So in this project, the thing that I really want to focus you on is what happens when you perform something that has been recorded and kind of written down. I think, and I guess the proposal is that there's a sort of transformative process that takes place when something is recreated as a live event, as opposed to just read off a page. So just to show you a few images of this piece, it involved a sort of whole-scale reconstruction of Stanley Milgram's laboratory in Yale University from 1961, including all of the kind of electrical equipment that enabled this experiment to take place. And as I said, it involved administering punishment to a sort of unwilling, sort of protesting subject. And you can see there in the photograph that machine in the background, which I have another shot of here. And that's actually a sort of fake electric shock generator. One of the key things about this piece of work, and indeed all the work that I've done, is that it focuses on the idea of a live experience as I hesitate to use the word because I don't mean it in the way that I'm about to say it, as an unmediated experience, but actually as a profoundly mediated experience. And that I think is probably easiest to explain in the context of this experiment, where the punishment that was administrated to somebody, a sort of unwilling subject, you can see them there, this guy sitting in the chair here, was through this machine, which supposedly the subject of the experiment believed generated electric shocks. So the subject in the experiment, imagine you're in the experiment, you believe that you're giving electric shocks to that man strapped in the chair. And the experiment revolves around whether or not you're prepared to obey the scientist who asks you to continue giving lethal doses of electricity to this person in the other room. The premise is sort of around a kind of spurious sort of memory learning test. The crucial thing about this experiment is that it is itself a piece of artifice, a piece of theatre. So there isn't, the electric shock generator is fake, it doesn't generate any electric shocks. The person who is supposedly receiving the electric shocks is actually an actor, and all his screams of pain are pre-recorded. So the whole experience for the person taking part in the original experiment is mediated and highly artificial. So what I was interested in was restaging that as a live experience. So and sort of asking the question, what happens when, first of all, when you articulate these transcripts, this sort of writing, which shows somebody under extreme duress having to make very difficult moral and ethical decisions about what they should do, sat in front of this machine. I think I have a shot. There's a detail of the machine. I think I have a shot of that. There we go. So what happens when you place somebody, an actor in this case, in front of the machine who's learned the transcripts literally as lines, and then replays them, but simulating all the kind of stress and emotion that we were able to sort of recreate from the from material from the original experiment, to a live audience. What happens to the live audience? How do they react? What do they think that they're seeing? And how does it change, in a way, the experience of that material from simply reading about it, or reading the transcripts? That was, in a way, the sort of premise. And also, of course, them not only knowing that the whole situation is staged, but also understanding clearly that the whole situation is staged and is itself based on the staging of something else. So there's a sort of weird thing here where mediation kind of just iterates through history, actually. So and the best way to explain that is for you to understand that. So the scientist figure you can see in the back here, who's the person who's conducting the experiment, conducting the recreation, is an actor. And in the real experiment, he was also an actor. So he was employed by the Stanley Milgram to sort of perform the role of the sort of authoritative scientist. So my actor is, of course, actually simulating the acting of the original actor. And then Milgram's hypothesis for this experiment is that in itself is referring to another event. So it mediates another event, which is essentially a kind of abstracted version of what happened during the Holocaust. Milgram was interested in testing that sort of common common Nazi sort of plea of saying that they were only following orders when they were asked to do something. So what happens as well when you place something in a kind of in a mechanized system and you ask them to do something inhuman? Will they do it, or will they not? And of course, the experiment is famous because the answer was an overwhelmingly yes, they will do exactly what they're asked to do. But for me, what was fascinating were these layers of artifice, and also the way in which they encapsulated the human drama that happens in front of the shock machine. So it was these kinds of layers and that human drama that I wanted to recreate. And I thought the best way of recreating it was simply to replay the experiment through the transcripts in real time. So this performance lasted for 4 hours, and my audience, in order to sort of mirror their experience, in order for them, for their experience to mirror the experience of the subject, I asked the audience not to leave the performance space for that whole 4 hours. So it's an extremely boring thing to sit and watch, actually. There are moments of tension and stress, but for the most part, it's very, very tedious to watch this kind of scientific protocol be played over and over again, and then to watch, actually, essentially what you see is a simulation of someone executing somebody else, which mostly is most of the subjects do this, the majority of subjects do this. So the relationship then to this and the archive was, as I said, primarily about this idea of articulating this material, really, in this live way and embedding in it all these kind of layers of mediation and artifice. That was my kind of primary aim. So I think we should sort of, and there's just a shot of the performance underway, the recreation underway. You can see we did it with Mil Graham tested a whole range of, a spectrum of people, different genders, classes, professions, and I tried to kind of mirror his sort of the sort of statistical sort of mean, if you like, of his experiment. So there you can see a female subject going through the experiment. And finally then video documentation of it. So in a sense this piece actually becomes its own archive and is exhibited as a video document and also as a large installation as well. The installation is sometimes recreated for museums. Okay, next project. This is a very different proposition. And this is a large sculpture that I was commissioned to make by the Lang Gallery in Newcastle in 2002. And this sculpture is an 18th century brainwashing machine, I think is probably the simplest way of describing it. It's a recreation from blueprints, drawings, writings by a man called James Tilley Matthews, who was incarcerated in Bethlehem or Bedlam, as we now know it, for some sort of 10, 15 years, around 1800. And he spent most of that time there writing a detailed instruction manual, really, for how he believed this machine functioned and what its purpose was. He believed that its purpose was a weapon of war, and he believed that these machines were installed around London, and they were being staffed by French revolutionaries, with the aim of controlling the mind of the Foreign Secretary and the Prime Minister, William Pitt, at the time, to basically propel England into war with France, so that the sort of revolution could kind of conquer and triumph over England. And this kind of delusion that he had is interestingly kind of complex. His biographically, his kind of journey in his life took him to France, and he was at one point a negotiator for the British government, and then was incarcerated in France by the more kind of radical element of the revolution. He escaped, came back to England, tried to make contact with the British government again, who basically sort of denied all responsibility of having anything to do with him, but then subsequently had him incarcerated in Bedlam. And there is actually a famous letter from the Home Secretary saying that on no account must he ever be released. He was in fact released from Bedlam, but on no account should he ever be released, which was a very unusual thing for a Home Secretary to do with a kind of individual. So without going into the biography of this man, there is some evidence that he was a kind of political prisoner. At any rate, he had this delusion of this incredible machine, this sort of 10 metres by 10 metres high machine, and the machine was there using sort of technologies that he sort of associated with sort of movement of gases and ether and magnetism to throw sort of these magnetic rays that would have all these kinds of horrible effects on its victims, on its intended victims. And this is just a little snapshot from his book, which was published by the Apocryphy of Bedlam. And this just shows you what the machine runs on. So you can see here that it runs on seminal fluid, male and female, effluvia of copper, gas from the anus of the horse, human gas, gas of the greasy heels, and Egyptian snuff. So that's just the kind of level of detail in this book. And then this is some of them. This is some of the detail of the effects that the machine has. So there's one particular effect you can see at the bottom of this page called kiting, where he talks about the machine being able to somehow sort of raise a thought into somebody's mind and kind of fix it there, really, so that it's impossible for the person to think about anything else. So what interested me about this was, let's just go back to this, what interested me about this machine was that there seemed to be this enormous material about it, that it seemed possible to make it, basically. But obviously it never had existed and clearly sort of would, never would. So I thought, as a sort of question about this sort of nature of recreation, I thought what I wanted to do was to make a very, very faithful sort of construction from Tilly Matthews' blueprints. And in some senses, the idea behind this was to make something as authentically detailed as possible, and in some senses then represent that moment in time in as most accurate way possible, but only from one person's point of view. So there was obviously a sense in which manifesting this machine in the world was a bit like sort of manifesting Matthew's delusion in the world as well, in a kind of palpable material way. But it was nevertheless a very, very accurate historical recreation, except that only from the point of view of one person's perspective. As far as everyone else in the world was concerned, this was just a sort of crazy apparatus that couldn't work. But I set about trying to recreate this using all of the available research material that I could get my hands on. And actually, I was lucky because it so happened that a friend of mine, Mike Jay, was at the time writing this book, which is a dramatised account of James Tilly Matthews' life, the Heirloom Gang. And so Mike had been to France and looked at lots of the archives, where actually there's quite a lot of documentation of James Tilly Matthews' life. And he'd also done quite a lot of research in the Bethlehem Museum archive. So there was a lot of material he had to hand that was actually very useful for me. It meant I didn't have to go and do all of that primary research. And Mike and I would meet on a kind of fairly regular basis and kind of discuss the best ways in which this thing should be recreated. Obviously, the level of detail that I wanted to construct in the sculpture was not actually available in Matthews's original documentation. So there were things, for instance, like these leather hoses, which are described and illustrated in Matthew's book, but not really in enough detail to recreate. So in that instance, I got in contact with the chemistry curator at the Science Museum, the chemistry curator at the time, at the Science Museum, and sort of had a discussion with him about around 1800, if you wanted to transport gaseous material from one object to another object, how would you do it? What would be the method that you would use to do it? And there really were only two solutions. One was to use pig's intestine, and the other one was to use oiled leather. And obviously the pigs intestine wasn't really suitable for this, because it was too small. It was mainly used for sort of small kind of scientific experiments. So obviously we kind of used leather. It's also interesting that early fire hoses, for instance, were also made out of oiled leather. So as a consequence, that sort of determined the material and also the kind of technique that this thing was fabricated from. So just to sort of give you a kind of for instance of the sort of decision-making process that I entered into when I was making this. So that wasn't just to do with the idea of sort of consulting the available material that Matthews had. It was also very much to do with actually kind of talking to people around who had that expert knowledge and could then kind of give it to me in order that I could then make this thing that in a way that would be in a way that would sort of approximate the knowledge that was available about the materials of that time and how to make them. Likewise, actually, for the body of the machine, which you can see here, these kind of panels. So I talked to somebody who knew about 18th century joinery, and we discussed how the best way in which the actual something of that size would have been fabricated. So literally, what kind of wood it would have been made out of, what size the panels, what was the biggest size the panels could have been, what was the biggest size the planks could have been, that kind of thing, really, that kind of detail. Okay, and then moving along to the next project, which is a bit more recent, and this is a collaboration with the novelist and artist Tom McCarthy, who some of you may have come across, his book Remainder, which focuses around reenactments. And this, Tom and I have been talking for a long time, and we decided to make a piece of work together, which actually is in itself, and in a sense, this is the piece that I thought I'd sort of focus on the most, which is in itself involves the construction of an archive. In fact, it involves the construction of an archive from other archives. So, I mean, it really kind of suits, I suppose, the topic of this seminar series. So you can see here that it's actually an archive of mostly of media, and actually it's Victorian media. It's media actually from around 1894, 1895, and I'll explain why that is in just a second. You can see here that it's kind of presented in a sort of rudimentary kind of display system. This was in Beaconsfield Gallery in London. And the media doesn't just include paper, it also includes photographs and an early film, which I will show you in just a moment. And it all revolves around this building, which is Greenwich Observatory in just outside of London, in Greenwich Park. And it involves around an event that took place in February in 1894, when a French anarchist took a pipe bomb to the observatory, and it would appear intended to try and attack the observatory with a pipe bomb. He failed and ended up actually detonating the pipe bomb prematurely and killing himself, blowing himself to pieces, just on the right of this photograph, actually, just in these trees, on the path up towards the observatory. At the time, this was the first anarchist attack, or attempted attack, on English soil. There were many, many anarchist attacks on the continent, and at the time there was a kind of fear, actually, of anarchism in general, but particularly the kind of methods that anarchists were using, the methodology that they called propaganda by deed, spreading ideas through throwing bombs, particularly in Italy and Germany, there were actually quite a lot of bombings. Quite a lot of people were killed in all kinds of different places in France. People were killed in cafes and restaurants, in theatres, in a whole range of different locations. And many of the anarchists, so the authorities thought, had made England as their base, and were travelling from England to the continent. And this is very sort of potted history of anarchism again, without really much time to sort of talk in detail about this. But at any case, the event that I'm interested in, and the event that this project really documents, is this attempted attack on the observatory, where this man, Marshall Bourdin, takes a pipe bomb to the observatory in the afternoon, in one February afternoon, and prematurely detonates, killing himself. The result of this is a sort of kind of media hysteria. So this became front page news, and all of the newspapers of the day for 2 weeks or more. So Tom and I decided that what we would do is rethink this episode, rethink this event. And what we were really interested in was the spectacular potential that Bourdin's act had, and sort of hadn't been realised. So we thought that we'd make a piece that realised that sort of potential spectacular explosion. So in our version of this event, the observatory is destroyed. So we went about collating from the National Archives and from the Colindale section of the British Library all of the material that both documents this event and also documents anarchism at around that time, and from that selected a kind of sample of material which we then changed and doctored. So we doctored newspapers, we doctored photographs, and as you'll see in a moment, we even kind of made an early 19th century film of the aftermath of the explosion. And in our version of the event, Bourdin is successful in attacking the observatory, and the observatory is destroyed by fire some hours after the attack, as a consequence of the attack. And this is what the newspapers report. So the way that we went about doing this was, let me just show you the film first as well. So this is a 50-second film, shot on 35mm on a hand-cranked 19th century camera that runs at, I think it was 16 or 18 frames a second. You'll see. So obviously this film didn't exist. It's entirely fabricated, and as I say, was shot on the original technology of the day. And then obviously the kind of the aftermath of the explosion is a digital post-production. But it was shot actually at Greenwich and in front of the observatory, and from an angle where the observatory doesn't look significantly different to how it would have looked in 1894. So in fact, I had photographs at almost of this angle of the observatory from the observatory's own archive. They actually kindly gave us access to their archive as well for us to do what we wanted to their material. So we doctored some of their own photographs of the observatory. So back to the other media, back to the print media. So at the Colindale, we found this material and then basically reinserted our own narrative into the text of the narrative that recounts the attempted attack. So in some cases, this meant really substantially altering the story that the newspaper reported. But in many cases, actually, it just meant really changing a few lines here and there. Because the kind of hysteria that the newspapers really were so sort of focused on really made you read their accounts as if the observatory had been attacked, so and successfully. So all we really needed to do was change the facts, the actual tone of the reporting, and actually most of the description was pretty much in keeping with the rest of our narrative. And so really it was just a matter of actually rearranging the narrative and creating a new timeline, a sort of minute by minute timeline of what happened that afternoon. So the way that this installation works is that each newspaper really documents a different fragment of this story. So if you spend some time in this installation walking around it, you gradually piece together this timeline that sort of occurs throughout that day, and then in the subsequent 2 days afterwards, when Bourdain's body's been found, and there's a sort of full-scale investigation, and also a sort of crackdown on anarchism, anarchists meeting places, police raids, seizures, arrests, etc., etc. And this really, so some of this is not changed, some of this really happened, and some of it is changed. Obviously, the key thing here, then, is in kind of making this new archive, what Tom and I were really interested in doing was introducing these kind of fictional premises into something that was really very, very carefully researched and carefully kind of reproduced. So that as an audience member, when you go and see, or a visitor, when you go and see this piece, this installation, it's made very, very clear to you that some of the material, that first of all, that what you're seeing is partially fictional, and that obviously some of the material that you're looking at is also partially fictional. What's not made clear is exactly what's fictional and what's not. So in a sense, as a visitor to this installation, you know, the sort of challenge to you really is to read through this material and try and have some sense of where fiction lies. And obviously this is really, really beautifully facilitated by the writing style of the time, which was itself incredibly narrative based. It was very unlike the kind of reporting style that we had now. And Tom's main role in this project was actually to sort of write in the style of this sort of journalism of that time. So just to give you a kind of snapshot of what these things look like, obviously this exhibition is mainly about, or this piece is mainly about text, so you really can't experience it here. But some of this, so for instance, you can see obviously the photograph is obviously being doctored, and so is some of the text. So where it says that the main damage to the building occurred, but the column on the left, which is just a sort of general column about the fear of anarchism, you can see the first line there talks about the dynamiting of the civilized world. It is actually unchanged. That's just as it is, as were the rest of the papers. So the rest of the front page of the paper. So we were really changing as little as we can. We also wanted to kind of include in this kind of media sphere of fragments that report this event, we wanted to include other material too. So we also wanted to look at this event from the anarchist perspective. So we also reproduced and doctored anarchists' publications as well. And this is the Commonweal, which was, before it was taken over by anarchists, was edited by William Morris. And it's an obituary of Bourdain. And in this, I mean, I'm not going to show you the detail, but in this piece, for instance, we changed just a couple of lines. So it pretty much remains intact. There's just another installation view, so you can see how all of this material is arranged. And of course, some of the papers that we were reproducing still exist now, like the Evening Standard. And in fact, that picture that I showed you earlier of Bourdain was actually from The Sun. Then, of course, there are the visual material, the visual media as well. So there's both drawings and photographs, and we doctored that too. So in each case, you usually show the observatory after the attack. So this is just from a kind of a magazine that came from the National Archives, and it's really just an article about the observatory, which we then kind of turned into obviously an article about the observatory that was, rather than the observatory that is. Likewise, these photographs came from the observatory's own archive, which we were a bit distressed to see was just basically a bunch of these absolutely, you know, photographs where there are no negatives for, shoved together in a filing cabinet in the back of the curator's kind of office. And she sort of just said, well, you know, just help yourself, take it out and just do whatever you want with it, really. We don't really know what to do with it. So these photographs actually, you know, are right there at the moment in the curator's office. But obviously don't look like this. The observatory doesn't look ruined. It looks much more intact. And then, you know, we wanted really also to extend this idea of these kind of fragments of media, I guess, into a more kind of 21st century forensic sort of approach to what, first of all, what constitutes media and what constitutes a kind of fragment of evidence. So this is these are the contents of Bourdain's pockets at the moment of his death. So these are basically the things that Bourdain found in his pockets when he died. So I'll just sort of show you here. So he had two invitations to a masked ball, the proceeds which were to be donated to the Revolutionary Party, and also an explosives recipe as well, stuffed in one of his pockets. One of the other things about the way in which we wanted to present this material as well, and I think this is a really key thing about this idea of relating what, you know, this idea between creating and recreating, was that one of the things I think that runs through what I'm interested in doing, and certainly with this piece with Tom, we were absolutely, you know, focused on doing this, was this idea that these recreations don't properly exist in time. They exist outside of time in some kind of way, because they're not properly located in the present, but they're clearly not located in the past either. Where particularly, I guess I'm talking about a live piece, like, for instance, the Milgram piece that I made. So they occupy this really strange kind of hybrid moment that isn't properly located anywhere. And my kind of hope for this is not actually then that somehow I accurately recreate an event, but actually I'm able to kind of unhook that event in some ways from its original historical place, from the moment in which it occurs, and displace it and use it actually as a way of commenting and interjecting into the present. So obviously with this piece, you can see that these materials that would have been found in Bourdain's pocket would have been charred and in shreds. The police had to kind of literally piece things together. We've read this from the police reports from the time. What we were interested in doing was recreating it as if it exists in this kind of virtual space where the explosion had never really taken place, where nothing was damaged. There's no, you know, there's no sense in which these pieces of paper have been subjected to an explosion, nor 100 years of history. The newspapers in this installation look like they were printed yesterday. They're not meant to look like they were printed 100 years ago. And I've held those materials in the Colindale. I know what 100 years does to a newspaper print. And really, they don't look like the pieces in this in this installation. So there was a very deliberate attempt to place things outside of time in some kind of way in order to open up a space of kind of reflection and examination, rather than a kind of way of just kind of methodically and trying to recreate something as if that were possible, as if it were possible to somehow reoccupy a space, a moment in the past or an event in the past, which I think both Tom and I think is not possible, and actually not, nor is it a desirable thing to do, actually. So just a few more images of this, just to give you another sense of the breadth of media that we kind of recreated. So this is the self-explanatory, really, Manifesto Dynamiteurs, the Dynamiteurs Manifesto. Although in French, it was published in London. And then another piece of sort of, if you like, micromedia, which is a recreation of the telegram that the police sent to Bourdain's brother, asking him to come to Greenwich to identify his brother's body. And so again, we used a similar methodology here to the heirloom, where although I've read what this telegram, the information this telegram included, I've not actually seen a facsimile of it. So this exhibit was recreated from, for instance, from actually finding out exactly what telegrams looked like in 1894, how much they cost to send, and what information would have been on it, and then recreating it from that information. And then here's some other material as well. So this is an anarchist pamphlet and a letter to the Prime Minister. I'm not sure who it's from, I can't remember, but basically wondering what they should be doing about these pamphlets that are being produced in London advocating sort of the assassination and bombing campaigns. And then finally, the one thing in this exhibition, which isn't media, which we really couldn't resist recreating, was Bourdain's bomb. And this is this. So we made this bomb. Again, I'll just tell you just briefly about the process that we went about making this. We took all of the reports, the newspaper reports and police reports, that in some detail recounted the kinds of fragments of material that were found lodged in Bourdain's body. And we took them to a bomb maker, a man who's employed by the MOD to make kind of experimental weaponry. And part of the installation is an interview with him where he shows from this research material what kind of bomb he's pretty certain would have been Bourdain would have used. And that includes not just like the fact that it was a pipe bomb, but also that it would have been, for instance, made out of cast iron rather than steel, that's in the police reports. The kind of explosives material that would have been used, so potassium chlorate in this case, and the sort of detonator. And then the police report descriptions describe Bourdain, people seeing Bourdain carrying this brown paper parcel with him to the observatory. There are witness reports of him doing this. So I went to the post office museum and I asked them to show me the earliest example they had of brown paper, brown wrapping paper. And of course it wasn't brown at all, it was actually a kind of off-white colour. And had a completely different kind of texture and a different sort of manufactured completely differently to the kind of brown paper that we now associate with wrapping parcels. So you know, a description of brown paper translates into actually something that looks more like this. Okay, so just a few closing comments then. Because I think there's only one more image to show you. So again, another recreation or fabrication in this case, of a stereoscopic photograph, a popular form of Victorian media that I fabricated from scratch, which shows the moment sort of, you know, of the observatory catching fire. So you can just see there that sort of faint silhouette of the observatory in the background and kind of plumes of smoke issuing from it. Obviously, the very deliberate reference to of this installation is, of course, September the 11th. That's actually really what this installation is really documenting, actually, not a bombing attack in 1894 at all. And what it seeks to do is to draw a kind of historical parallel with events that happened 100 years ago and events that happen now, and the way in which the media reacts to them, and the way in which events are constructed and remembered through media, really, to the degree where I think Tom and I would argue that in a sense the media is those media artifacts are actually responsible in some senses of generating, having a kind of sociological impact on the way in which we understand the original event. So for us, it was instructive to look back at this moment and see, you know, look at the kind of level of anxiety and fear that this event generated, and also look at the way in which the narratives which I haven't spoken about actually, that this event generated were so parallel to the ones of today. A kind of hysteria about the idea of, you know, the England becoming a kind of haven for terrorists, the idea that this was the immigration laws need to be tightened down, stereotypes about race and belief systems that aren't part of the mainstream, you know, anarchism being one of them. So a whole raft of things that are incredibly resonant. And I guess I kind of want to end on a sort of anecdotal thing, which was I completed the research for this piece in July 2005. So myself and my researcher, Chloe Vitsou, would travel on the tube from South London up to the Colindale Library, which is in North London. And this was in late July. It was about 1 or 2 weeks after the tube attacks on London. So the tube was pretty empty. No one was travelling. Anyone who would have been in London at that time would know that no one was travelling on the tube at that time. We would get on empty tubes, have a whole carriage to ourselves. And of course, you know, people had been on the tube, and in that kind of, you know, that thing that is very typical of the tube, there were papers littered all over the carriages on these kind of empty tubes. And Chloe and I would travel on them, take this hour journey every day up to the Colindale, kind of sifting through this sort of detritus on the tubes. There were these headlines about, you know, this event that had happened in 2 weeks ago in London, you know, with the tube bombing. And we would then get to the Colindale, and we would basically read the same headlines under the microfiche from newspapers that were 100 years old. And it was really almost possible in some cases just to swap the word Islamist for anarchist. And you could almost have the same kind of reporting, written in a different style, written with a different kind of journalistic language, but essentially fleshing out the same kind of narrative and the same sorts of ideas, fears, and also, of course, kind of calls for action of some kind. So that I hope you can see by finishing with that kind of anecdotal that sort of anecdotal point, is that I'm really not actually that interested in what happened in 1894, nor really am I that interested actually in what happened in 1961 when Milgram undertook his experiment. What I'm really interested is the way in which archives and history can be brought to bear on the present. That's really the sort of thrust of all of this work. And I'm sure that I've just spoken for like way too long. I'm really sorry.
We've got some time for discussion, so would people like to pick up on points that Rod's made or come in?
First?
Yes.
I've just been reading something about this concept of a preemptive imagination.
Yeah.
It's a kind of a reworking of this idea of remediation, to recast it to pre-mediation.
Right.
And its argument is about, you know, how one can think about media response to any kinds of shock event, trauma after 9/11.
Yeah.
And its argument is that media increasingly imagines something that's about to happen rather than drawing on
in
the way that you do. And it kind of struck me as it's not really a question, it's a kind of comment in relation to your strategy of enlivening the present through taking this historical approach, which in a way is quite typical.
It's quite typical,
you know, quite sort of common strategy
of
anyone working in a kind of historical materialist tradition.
Yeah. I mean, I think absolutely that. Listening to. I've kind of got to a point where I've just actually stopped reading papers and things now. Because actually, I think more than 50% of it, quite often, it would exactly feel this thing of sort of being preemptive, preemptive speculative material. So, I mean, I think it's fascinating. For me, it's fascinating that kind of situation arises. It just seems to open up an amazing space to operate in as an artist, with all kinds of incredible possibilities. I'm not sure how useful it is as a sort of newsworthy thing.
Yeah, I think the stress this person makes is on mediality itself, and that's the way you started your talk, by contemplating the mediality.
Yeah.
You ended it with what seems like a more kind of common strategy of thinking about the way history can bear upon the present.
I mean, I suppose the thing that really interests me is sort of the idea of templates, really. Templates of, you know, templates of behaviour. So whether that's, you know, media behaviour or human behaviour, and the way in which those things can just be kind of very simply constructed and played out, and are continually played out in different ways. So I mean, I'm working on another piece that deals with sort of political speeches and the sort of use of sort of templates in political speeches, and type of language that sort of brought to bear in political speeches to you know, create kind of emotional responses in people. And again, you can see the same thing happening. You can see the same thing. So you look through archives, and you can find these kind of repeated, this repeated structure, basically.
Well, yeah, I was just going to ask about the Milton piece in particular, where the performance actually happened.
That happened in the Centre for Contemporary Art in Glasgow, 2002.
Maybe you could say a bit more about the fact that these remediation events are staged in completely divorced contexts from the research project, in a sense. So I'm kind of interested in the experience that the viewer comes to the work with.
Yeah.
Whether they get the staging, whether they get the faking.
Yeah, actually, that's a good point, and it's very important that these things happen in art spaces, actually. So for instance, I don't think the Milgram piece would have worked at all if you'd staged it in a faculty of psychology. They need to be, and likewise with the Greenwich, I don't think the Greenwich installation would work at all well if it was. I mean, there was some interest from the Maritime Museum, actually. They were quite interested in it. And I thought it really wouldn't work to stage it there, because it needs a kind of space where, in a sense, it's sort of remit, or the expectation of people coming to it is that, in some sense, it's going to challenge them, and that there's a sense in which what you're confronted with in an art space can't be really taken for granted. That the challenge to you, the visitor, is to be questioned or to question, and because all of these pieces involve some element either of that kind of layered mediation, or actually just simply, you know, taking a particular perspective, or falsifying history, or taking a particular perspective on history, it's necessary that the visitor understands that, or at least is prepared to engage with that idea, rather than simply just take it for read, as they might say, a museological situation where they see it as purely instructional. So it is actually important that they were in art spaces, that they all happen in art spaces.
Has the Greenwich piece toured elsewhere?
Yeah, the Greenwich piece is. The Greenwich piece is on its way to New Zealand at the moment, and it's just finished being exhibited back in Utrecht in the Netherlands. It's on its way to an art space in New Zealand. And in fact, there's a kind of nice circularity about this, actually, in that, you know, all of this material gathered from an archive, and then to create an archive, and that now that piece is now in the Arts Council collection, and they're basically getting ready to archive it themselves. So there's this sort of weird kind of circularity that's happened to that piece.
I wanted to pick up on that question about audience and expectations, and you half answered the question I was going to ask by saying it's to be seen in art spaces. I'm also wondering how far you set up the expectations and how far you set up those questions for the audience, or when you just throw them into the work and let the work speak for itself.
No, there is actually quite an intricate process of contextualisation, actually. So, for instance, with the Greenwich piece, there's a text that goes with the piece. It's not very long. It's only like about four paragraphs long, and it just really outlines. I think I mentioned it actually. It simply outlines a paragraph about the event, and then the idea that the what you're about to see is fictionalized, that the observatory wasn't destroyed. So kind of in a way sets the scene really for what you experience. So I think the important thing about these works is when I use, you know, methods sort of fabrication, there's no attempt to trick the audience. Actually, that's very, very important. So actually, what I didn't mention with the heirloom piece, there is a that piece is exhibited with an audio guide. So and the audio guide is basically a kind of re-narration of James Tilley Matthews' documents, his writings, except spoken in a kind of museological 21st century language. So, and it directly contradicts what's actually the sort of text panels on the wall that just gives you it absolutely straight that this is a reconstruction of something from, you know, Bedlam Museum. So on the one hand, the idea is to sort of literally create a very literal paradox in the audience where what they're hearing through their ears and reading are two totally different things. So there's a sort of sense in which the way in which people experience that, I guess, really varies. So if you read the text first, then you have a different experience of the audio and the piece than if you just listen to the audio, which is very convincing and really plays out exactly like those kinds of instructional museum audio guides. Very authoritative, you know, giving you very exact information, telling you where to stand, what you're looking at, you know, why this thing is made the way it is and what it does, how it works, etc. So I guess if you hear that first and then encounter the text, you have another kind of reading of it that you sort of experience everything in a slightly different order. But the information is there, and I'm not interested in sort of tricking the audience in some kind of way. That's not the point of these things.
The Milgram stuff I knew, but I haven't seen the Greenwich material. The first and third project that you showed us seemed to me to also be doing something that, well, this is my take on what they also seem to be doing, is that they work against the kind of linear construction of history or the othering of history as somehow something that could be preserved in archives, maybe, that they're somehow outside of the present.
Yeah.
And I think that that's a really interesting thing, that then has this consequence of kind of staging and affirming the cyclical nature of history, and puts the archive into a different relationship with the contemporary. Was that something that was, you know, you knew that that was going to be part of what you were doing from the outset, or was it a kind of a consequence of going and working with those archives?
It was something that I knew that I was interested in before I started the Milgram piece. I made another earlier piece, first reenactment piece I made was in 2000, and that in a way kind of set up the sort of structure that I thought I was interested in working with for a while, and that was actually a much more straightforward reconstruction in some ways actually, but from that I think I generated this sort of understanding of how history could play out, how research materials could play out, and also actually the idea of a kind of informational artwork as well, and how one situates an informational artwork, what actually constitutes even an informational artwork, and its relationship to live experience and performance as well. So, because I suppose actually one thing I haven't really talked about that much is also the role of, I talked about it a bit with the Milgram piece, but it's the sort of role of mediated performance, actually. So, the short answer is I was obviously kind of intending to investigate those things, but I didn't really know how. I mean, you know, each project comes along and generates its own sort of life and its own kind of inquiries, I couldn't tell you in 2 years' time what I would be doing. So.
Are there any other questions or comments?
Just going to say that in relation to the way that your media can actually present events in the past, that sort of thing really adds to the pressure that you sometimes feel as an archivist in terms of how you select what needs to be preserved. How you arrange it in your catalogue, you do feel a certain amount of social responsibility that you think, well, what I choose to keep is going to have an impact on how people see this organisation or this event.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a bit scary, really, to see what you can do with what we would think of as factual evidence. Often with the inquiries that we have in, even with what you consider to be authentic archive records, the gaps they try to fill in are just incredible, the leaps that they try to make and say, oh, well, X, Y, and Z happened like this. And you sort of think, well, most of us wouldn't trust what a newspaper says today, so why are you taking what a newspaper said, you know, 100 years ago as fact? So it's kind of, it fits really with our experience.
I mean, I would have thought, you know, as an archivist, if you've got to make those kind of selections, you're almost operating like a film editor, really. I mean, you sort of create the meaning through what you select and preserve.
Yeah, exactly.
And what gets deleted is, you know, part of that editing process, exactly like a film editor would work.
Yeah, I suppose so. What you select as well depends on what you've actually got available to you. So the evidence you have and what survives, you know, there could be big parts of the picture that are missing, and it's hard to resist trying to fill those bits in yourself.
I think that's interesting as well, because it challenges that view of the archive as just this kind of repository of raw materials waiting for interpretation by the researcher.
The other interesting thing as well, actually, in all of this, you know, research was about, you know, like for example, the Milgram piece, which is, you know, probably the most famous social psychology experiment that's ever been conducted. And they have, admittedly, they have a huge archive, but I was taking transcripts out of the out of their archive, or getting copies of them made and sent to me, that they said that no one had looked at for 25 years. So you sort of, there's another weird thing where you kind of understand that the history of this experiment, basically, is actually down to a very small amount of primary research that has been done a very, very long time ago, and that actually nobody has actually gone back and really looked at this material they have and sort of tried to kind of reassess it, or even just review it, you know, without even any particular agenda to it. And I thought that was really extraordinary, actually. I kind of imagined that it would almost be the case that it would all be sort of out, being looked at, and I wouldn't even be able to, you know, get my hands on it. In fact, it was completely the opposite.
I came across a piece of writing about the Milgram experiment recently that completely reinterpreted it as an experiment in people's capacity or desire to be cruel to one another once given license. And it was like, you know, when the whole thing is about authority, in the sense that, and it's interesting as well that there's the myth, there's a kind of, it just becomes a myth, doesn't it? It continues to be remediated and otherwise people want to use it.
Yeah. The other thing I was going to say as well, just carrying on about archives, was to say, the other thing that I've just been totally shocked by is the way that people look after things. I mean, that's just unbelievable, really. I mean, you go to the Colindale, and I'm holding these 100-year-old newspapers, and they're letting me hold them. And you can see that they're just falling to pieces. And I'm just thinking, God, I shouldn't be touching this stuff, really. And the same with Greenwich, you know, curator was sort of, you know, wandering around with his filing cabinet, and these things were just, these, you know, original photographs. They don't have negatives for, they don't have copies of, they don't have digital copies. I bought my scanner and a scanner, and she's going, oh, can we have the scans? We haven't got any digital copies of this stuff. And it's just rammed together, shoved into this filing cabinet.
Yeah, it's that age-old conflict, really, with archivists of access versus preservation. You do want to make sure that things survive for the future, but there's kind of no point them surviving if nobody's ever actually going to look at them. So it's like your point about the fact that there is a vast amount of material that people don't look at, you know, for 20 years. It's so disappointing when you work your way through a collection to make it available to people, and then you find, you know, 10 years later that still nobody's looked at it.
Yeah.
But it's just the feeling that, you know, it could be useful to somebody, and it represents, you know, that's all that's left of a really important part of the history of your locality or the people who lived there or the events that happened.
But I wonder if there's a thing about the way in which people value material as well. And because my, you know, my other experience, for instance, was exhibiting the heirloom in the Prinzhorn Institute and galleries in Heidelberg. And I don't know if anyone is aware of this, but the Prinzhorn collection is this incredible collection of sort of between the wars psychiatric artwork collected from institutions around Germany. It regularly tours. There were big exhibitions of it at the Hayward Gallery and at the Whitechapel a couple of years ago. So it's kind of stadium. They loan stuff out. And when I first went there, Thomas, the director, said, "Well, you must come and see our archive," you know. And so I kind of got, and I mean, that's just the exact opposite. You go downstairs, and it's this airlocked room with artwork has its own, you know, kind of humidity-controlled crate. The whole thing is just these sliding walls. It's like going to some sort of James Bond kind of, environment. And then, and the other thing about that experience was so extraordinary and tallied so well with, you know, my experience here at Greenwich, was that in the corner of this white, pristine archive where people were walking around with gloves on and virtually, you know, breathing masks, was this kind of crumpled old cupboard in the corner. And I sort of gave them, what's that thing doing here? You know, it's really dirty old sort of cupboard just sat in the corner. He said, well, we keep that. He said, because that's where, after the end of the Nazi era, basically after the Second World War, the Nazis cast all this material as degenerate art. And didn't actually destroy it, but basically just shoved it all in this cupboard. And this is where, basically, it was found. So in some corner of the Prince Ward after the Second World War, and it just seems such a contrast, you know, and yet that really reminded me of the way in which the material had been kept at Greenwich.
Yeah. It's very common that, I mean, if we had a conservator here, they would have told you that they take pictures of everything that they do, so whatever horrible state the records are in or whatever they've been shoved into,
They'll
take photographs to document that, so you can see the before and after effect of it, and it means that then it doesn't lose the context of its custodial history, basically. So we would, as archivists, try and record that information as far as we can in a catalogue description as well. So.
Yeah.